This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The following is a paid program and does not necessarily reflect the opinions and views of Cumulus Media and FM 103.7 and AM 710 KCMO, Kansas City's most stimulating talk. Percolate on a particular mix of odd and inspiring news headlines in Wendy's Coffee House. Newsmakers with a penchant for the unknown, unexplained, and unusual share their experiences with UFOs, ghost encounters, near-death experiences, and more for your own unique blend of Wendy's Coffee House Curious. And now, here's Wendy.
Hi there. Hope you're having a good night. Sunday already. It gets here way too fast. Okay. Interview tonight. Stick around. PMH Atwater, if you haven't heard her before, she's definitely interesting, and she's had three near-death experiences, so she might know a thing or two about what she's talking about. 1977, I think, was the first one. Dying to Know You is the latest book. She's written 15 books or more about all sorts of viewpoints on this topic, so she's coming up. And this was the big weekend for the Philip K. Dick Festival in Colorado, if you missed it. A lot of stuff, fun stuff happening with that. You know, he's the guy who wrote the show. It's now Blade Runner is what it is. There was actually no character ever named Blade Runner in the show. But the show is one of the things that he came up with without ever getting to see the end of it. Blade Runner 2049, coming out later this year. I think October is going to be the day for that. October month for that. I should get my day and month right. So one way or the other, it was a big festival in Colorado, and I've got the biography. I should have brought it in with me. He saw the pink light, and it's kind of a UFO ET interesting connection with that, and he has no explanation for it, but he wrote something called The Exegesis of Philip K. Dick, and it was like 900 pages trying to figure out what the heck happened and changed his life. Anyway, the movie coming out, I thought it was so fascinating that he had never, ever seen the end of it. He died 3 months before the Blade Runner film came out. And it was another interesting thing that the people who put it together, they didn't actually read the book, the entire book. And the name Blade Runner came from another story completely. And it all works so well and fits together. And the next one should be fabulous. But coming up, we've got Logan. And I've heard some really... The reviews on this are stellar. Patrick Stewart, of course, in this, along with Hugh Jackman. Patrick Stewart has decided he's going to apply for U.S. citizenship to fight Trump. His friends were saying, well, you know, you can do something since you live here and you're married to an American citizen. And so he said, you know what? I think I will. And so he's going to apply for citizenship. The stellar reviews on the movie, just taking a look at some of them, it's so good you might forget it's a comic book. That's saying something. And it's dark and it's risky. And Hugh Jackman apparently cried the last, well, he had a tear, maybe not cry, but he had a tear. And I saw this interview where Patrick Stewart is saying, well, look, if Hugh Jackman can have a tear, I can have a tear too. It was hard to say goodbye to the characters. So anyway, that's an interesting part of it. And then along the ET UFO lines, flipping back to that pink light scenario, there's a really cool place in Colorado. And this, apparently, they've known about it for a long time, and I don't know exactly right now. I don't have the way to the map, but you can find out about it. It's a UFO watchtower. And the lady who first moved here in 1995 to raise cattle said she was really, you know, fascinated by the stories that the locals were telling her. So she decided the ranch idea was no good. No word on whether there were any kind of extracurricular activities with that. But she built a watchtower. It's like 10 feet tall. And 60 people at a time can get up there and talk about UFO things. Anyway, she said 60 sightings since she opened it. Not too bad. And she's had 26 of her own. So I think this is Hooper, Colorado. out in the middle of, she says, great night skies. So if you want to go on a road trip, this would be the place to go. And there's also a vortex garden and lots of psychics and people who can tell you more about ETs or not. But I thought that would be a fabulous road trip, so you can check that out. The other stuff that's happening, nothing, you know, I mean, we've got a UFO, I think the meeting is going on, oh gosh, I don't have my MUFON calendar or my tinfoil hat. I've had a sighting, okay? So that's why I'm fascinated by it, more than a sighting. But and we'll talk about that when I've got Stan Seba coming in. I sent him a picture of something that I experienced that they wanted to, you know, see if it's legit. What can you tell me what this is? There's a guy who's doing now all sorts of analysis of the paperwork that they have compiled from experiencers, 3,057 of them, who have claimed to have some kind of contact and remember it, not under some kind of, you know, hypnotic induced, you know, tell me what you saw and how you felt it. No, it's just like out loud, yes, this is what I remember. I was conscious at the time and I had an encounter. All right, so this is Bob Davis, and he says he's an agnostic UFO, a UFO agnostic, retired neuroscientist, and he wants to put the pieces together in this puzzle. So fascinating stuff going on, and PMH Atwater has a couple of blogs, and she actually deals with the ET thing on one of the blogs, too. So it'll be fascinating to talk with her about all this stuff and how it makes sense. You can check out some of the news headlines. I also had some other things I put on there at the wendyscoffeehouse.com, some fantastic sci-fi stuff. Also, PMH Atwater she describes her 3 near-death experiences, got a video of that on there, and then the Valley of the UFOs, so you can find out more about where it is. It looks really flat. Which is convenient. So that's coming up a little bit later. But there's one little cool thing on there. This little classroom decided they lost their fish. You know what it's like to have a pet in your classroom when you're a kid. And losing them is tough. It's tough no matter where they are. But they had 2 fish. And I can't remember the names. Probably Bubbles and Oscar. Those are mine. Okay, I'll just substitute those names for the 2 fish in this story. And then they decided, since they were studying about the Vikings, they would give their fish a proper send-off. So you can see the picture of these children all lined up on the bank, about 20 or so, all lined up on the bank. This little thing floating in the water of the 2 fish having this lovely Viking send-off. Okay? It's just worth a look. All right, we'll be back with my special guest, PMH Atwater, dying to know you, next on Wendy's Coffee House.
When the ants come marching in, call Pete's Pest Control to stop them in their tracks. Online at PeteTheBugGuy.com.
I'm Scott Tannen, founder of Boll & Branch, where you can get the world's most comfortable sheets for less than half of what you'd pay in the store. Our sheets are made from 100% organic cotton and get softer over time. Even 3 U.S. presidents have Boll & Branch sheets. Try them for 30 nights. If you don't love them, send them back for a full refund. Go to BollAndBranch.com today for $50 off your first set of sheets, plus free shipping with promo code SLEEP. Spelled
FM 103.7 and AM 710. Stimulating talk. KCMO.
Wendy's Coffee House. Talk Radio KCMO. Thanks for listening. My guest, PMH Atwater, has been there, done that. 3 near-death experiences. Like I said, I put the video of that on the blog. At Wendy's Coffee House, you can hear her discussing that. And the book is Dying to Know You, Proof of God and the Near-Death Experience. And I spoke with her earlier. PMH, you've got a good voice now, right?
Yeah, I'm not a mouse anymore.
For a month, you were unable to speak?
Yeah, laryngitis, really bad. A really tough sinus infection, bloody nose, all this kind of stuff.
Okay, yeah,
and
that's...
I've just been well for a week now, so here we go.
Yay! Luck of the draw. I'm so glad you're up to talking tonight, because this is stuff people are so curious about. And finally, instead of making fun of it and poo-pooing it and saying people are just delusional and there's something that the brain is malfunctioning, the science and the details are now coming out saying these are legit experiences.
Oh, yeah, we now know it's real scientifically.
Finally.
Absolutely. Medically, scientifically. This is a real event.
Well, was it Pim Van Lommel? I'm trying to. There are 2 or 3.
Well, he's one of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who's the most famous for with?
Well,
their
I don't
experience?
Know who's the most famous. There's Pim. There's Fennec in England. There's Sam Parnia. Bruce Grayson. It goes on and on and on. Fabulous scientists who have done their work.
Okay, with this book, there's I like the way you've combined a lot of the different elements of the near-death experience, and you know what children, how they view it, and what is.
Well, don't you realize, dear, this is the people's book. There is no other book like it in the world. Never was, may not ever will be. I don't know, but it is the summary of nearly 4,000 adult and child experiencers of near-death states. It's their voices, their wisdom, their experience, their knowing. And all I did was sum it. So this is the people's book.
See, what I think is funny, I talked with you maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and you were saying, oh, I'm done with the near-death stuff. I think I'm over it. And then you went on to write a book on indigo children, I think. And then you came back with this one. So I don't think you're done with this yet.
Well, I keep getting these orders from headquarters.
Aha. Uh-huh. And you're marching.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So the upshot of this one with all of the experiences, just first, the child's version, because I like this, the afterlife and whether it exists or not. How do kids view it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. With kids, of course, you get the straight stuff. You know, they don't color it like adults do. They just come right out with it. And that makes it so wonderful in reading it, because then you can get, you know, just plain innocent material.
Well, they don't have the language that adults have. They're not into saying everything's an angel. There's descriptions are a little more vague, but at the same time, fascinating, because they give you an overview without the dogma.
Well, this is one of the great things with child experiencers. If they're very young, they've never heard of the word angel. So they don't use that word. And one of the ways you can know that it's a genuine experience, they'll talk about the people or the bright ones or the people in the light. So they're more to the point. They don't know words like angels.
You talked about one of the kids who was in the Joplin tornado.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a fascinating story, because they were talking about the butterfly people at that time. These were stories that just began to trickle out after that, and you're hearing in retrospect, because this was the book, May 15, 2012, talking about her experience. She was 6 when the tornado struck and killed everybody in her family. She was in a field all by herself, and she wrote to heaven after the storm.
Yes, and please get that book. It is so pure and so wonderful. It was a reporter there in Joplin that called me on the phone and said, you know, I know you've worked with child near-death experiencers. Here's the information I'm getting from all these kids. What do you make of it? And all the stories, never once was there an angel. That word, angel, mm-hmm. it was never used. And I said right away, I think you've got some legitimate material here. Let's take a look at it. Let's look deeper. And so the kids were calling all these little beings that were helping them and keeping them from going up into the funnels. They called them butterflies, because to a little child, that's what they looked like. They were butterflies. And the butterflies were literally pulling them, helping them to stay in the car or stay in their house or stay wherever they were. They were pulling them to safety, and they were the butterflies.
See, that is absolutely mind-boggling, to know that something could do that, that we're not able really to see as an adult.
Well, here we've got all these children. It's the children that are talking about it.
Yeah.
All the butterflies.
Okay, now the other thing about this girl, that she had some other information, and she knew her parents were going to die about 6 months before they did. Could you?
Yeah, yeah. Of course, you get this a lot with the new kids. The kids born since about 1982, they're so unusually intuitive and intelligent, and she was one of these kids. And she had a dream, and in her dream, she was shown and knew and saw that her parents would die. And so she and how? So she was prepared.
Wow.
And she had, as she said, she had these extra months to enjoy her family before they would be gone. And still today, though, the psychologists that are working with her won't let her go out on any tour or talk to anybody or even speak at the near-death conferences. You know, the International Association for Near-Death Studies, they're having their next conference this year in August in Westminster, Colorado.
Really?
But they won't let her go to any of these places yet. They don't think she's ready. She just lost too many members of her family.
Oh, my. Yeah. Yeah, the whole family. And to be there. And
Yeah, cousins and everything.
Yeah, to process this. But at the same time, it also sounds like, on another level, she has a tremendous support system.
She does. She does. And she has a lot of support system amongst other near-death experiencers, certainly the International Association, because we all know about her case because I told everybody. I spread the word, and not only in my books, but orally as well. And one of our people, Bill Guggenheim, who wrote something about after-death communication, he got a hold of her story, and he contacted her, was able to reach her and her psychologist, and they're now good friends. So I'm very glad and very grateful about that she has someone, an authority figure, or someone who at least is well-versed in the research to talk to and to be a good friend. So this is wonderful.
I wanted to make sure before I spoke up, it's Hello from Heaven. That was the interview, Bill and Judy interview.
Oh, yeah, Bill and Judy Guggenheim, who wrote the book Hello from Heaven. This is after-death communication.
Mm-hmm.
And the amazing thing is, I think it's, what is it, around 70% or 80% of those people whose loved ones have died, and then after the death, they come back in the sense of maybe a smell, maybe a voice, maybe a dream, maybe an actual manifestation at the end of their bed or walking down the hall. So they see and hear and talk to their loved ones after they have died. And there are so many people who talk about this, and, you know, that's their testimonial, but the fabulous thing is, when you look at all the thousands upon thousands upon thousands of cases they have, and this high percentage of people who are actually visited by loved ones after their death.
Yeah, I've had experiences. One of the ones that was the most powerful was my grandmother when she died, and she let me know there was a certain song she wanted played at her funeral. I Only Want to Dance With You, George Strait, was the one she wanted to have played, and I had no idea that she was a huge fan until my aunt and my other relatives filled me in, and that one of the things that she was so thrilled to have seen, even though it was difficult for her to walk, was a concert with George Strait. I'm like, good grief, I had no clue. But I got a few hits from her on things that she let me know, and it was one of the amazing things is when you lose somebody like that and you're grieving, my grandmother helped me. She basically took the grief away because it was that knot in your stomach, that pain, that intense sadness. I remember when she said, "I'm okay," and it just dissolved. And it was just like this energy, and it was gone. It was like 3 days, and then that when she gave me that boost, then it was gone. But it was because I didn't think I'd be able to talk at her funeral. I was like, oh, I can't do this. And then she was.
Then all of a sudden you find out you can.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's probably there beside you.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Helping you all the way.
So, yeah, so these kinds of things, I think it's helpful for people to share and talk about, because I remember, you know, 30 years ago when people were, you know, just whispers, I might have.
Oh, yeah.
And very careful who you said anything
to. Had to pull your curtain shut, you know, and nobody could see you reading these strange books or having people in your home who might talk to the dead or who might be aware of other dimensions or, you know, who might know about psychic kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what was it was taboo.
Yeah, very much. Very much. Now we've got so much science. We've got so much medical science behind a lot of this that I don't care who you are, whether you're an MD, a PhD, a disclaimer, you have to sit down and take a good long look.
What I think is so fascinating about some of this, too, is that the differences between experiences and experiencers. One can have this phenomenal experience, and it's on page 39 of your book about it was anybody else. Everybody's like, oh, my gosh, that's so powerful. That's fantastic. What a beautiful experience. And the guy says it was the worst thing that ever happened to him.
Right. We need to recognize the human element here. You know, we can go, oh, my gosh, by golly. But how does that really impinge on the individual? When we look at near-death cases, you have to keep that in mind because the individual will interpret their case, what happened to them. They'll talk about it in the language and understandings of their culture. So you've got these language constraints. And very often, you know, a person will be, you know, if their background is more fundamentalist, then they're going to talk in those terms. If their background is wide open, then they're going to talk in very different terms. You have to be very, you know, one of the things that I did in my own work is that I would have people draw their experience. So we've got people, for instance, in Vietnam, and they're talking about in death that they're met by Yamatuts. Yamatuts are the servants of the Lord Yama, king of the underworld. And so I'd have a friend of mine who was there ask the people to draw them. I'd have people from Montana draw their experience, people from North Carolina, people from Florida. You can't tell the difference in the drawings.
Wow.
You can't.
Okay.
The differences come in how we describe them and the language we use.
Yes. Yeah, because we each have different vernacular.
Right.
Okay, I want to get into something in this next segment. There's a fascinating story from a guy who was a Russian spy.
Well, yeah, kind of, sort of. He was a dissident.
Yeah, he was under the radar and not very popular because of his beliefs. And I would like you to I'd like to get into that one in the next break because it's just timely. It gives you a few details that might sound really familiar. In the way that they deal with dissidents. So, okay, so hang on just a second. Catch your breath, rest your voice. Okay, yeah. So
I promise not to be squeaky. Too
perfect.
Bad.
You're good. You're good. So far, we're doing great. Dying to Know You is the name of the book, Proof of God and the Near-Death Experience. This is the latest from PMH Atwater, and who's been studying this since, well, at least 1977 when she had her first...
1978.
78, okay. Oops, I was a little early.
Well, I'm 77. That's when I died.
Okay. So, yeah. So then talking about it in 78. And, you know, it's 17. My, how time flies. Okay. So we're going to take a quick break. And again, if you want to follow along, you can always do the download thing. And this podcast will be in the archives to follow along later on. But fascinating. And if you've had your own experience, you know what we're talking about. Once you have gone through this, it's real. It's very real. Nobody has to tell you. It's yours. And they can't take it away from you either. So coming up next, more with PMH Atwater. It's Wendy's Coffee House on Talk Radio, KCMO. We'll be back. It's so fantastic, these stories. And each one has its own vantage point. Like PMH Atwater was saying earlier, these are unique, and each person has their own way of viewing it. Like somebody who has a negative experience can say, wow, I'm so glad because now I know something. And the person who had a positive experience says, why did that happen to me? I did not deserve that. Okay. So the thing I think is fabulous is some of the details give us another perspective from people who might have been involved in questionable activities. And a dissident would be somebody who's basically a target. And this guy happens to have been Russian. And the details of his near-death experience, I thought, were fascinating, especially at this time, to have some of this come to light. So can you just kind of fill us in on that one?
Well, the name is George Rodinia. He was a doctor at the time. He was a communist dissident before that was cool, and was finally able to get the papers and everything together so that he and his family could leave Georgia, leave Russia, and finally, you know, immigrate to the United States. There was a church group in Texas that had agreed to sponsor him. So his wife and two children had left in a car to go to the Moscow. He was waiting for another car to pick him up. Well, come to find out, that car was driven by the KGB, and they knocked him down with the car, ran over him again and again and again with the car to make certain the man was dead. His body then was taken to the morgue in Tbilisi, Georgia. It was stored there in the freezer vault for 3 days. Now, it is true, we do not know the temperature in that freezer vault. But we do know he was kept in there, stored in there for 3 days, pulled out finally for an autopsy because, you know, it was a very vocal communist dissident. Mm-hmm. And he was on the autopsy table. One of his own uncles was part of the team. They were doing what is called the T-cut. And so they had cut open the bottom part of the torso of his body, that being the top of the T, and they were now going up the chest, the stem of the T, when he opened his eyes.
Oh,
now,
my.
That's not unusual. Mm-hmm. They closed his eyes, kept cutting, opened his eyes again. They didn't think anything of it, closed his eyes, kept cutting. And finally, he opened his eyes again and kept them open.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the chief of autopsy freaked out.
Yeah.
Couldn't
yep.
handle it.
Yep.
Had to take a month's vacation.
Oh, my. Yeah.
And we have the case of George Rodinia. Now, George required a great deal of surgery after that.
Mm.
They couldn't talk to the man for 3 days. I don't think most people realize that when you're dead, your tongue swells up and fills the mouth cavity.
Oh.
So there was no way he could speak until the swelling went down. So at the end of the 3 days, the first thing he did was talk about a friend of his wife, had given birth to a child, you know, in the birthing wards of this hospital. And George, in his out-of-body experience, one of many experiences he had while dead, had gone up there to see if she had delivered. Indeed, she had. And this little girl was screaming and crying and a little baby, and he said it was like X-ray vision. He could see right through, saw that her hips had been broken. He also saw that the head nurse had dropped the child. That's why the hips were broken. Uh-huh. And he told the child to shut up, quit crying, that he would take care of this. And so once he could speak, he told the doctors, get up there right away, X-ray this child. He described the break exactly. He described exactly what the head nurse had done. Then the doctors went up there. They X-rayed this baby. They found the hip break exactly, to the minute degree, exactly as George had described.
Mm-hmm.
They then confronted the head nurse. She admitted dropping the child. She was fired.
Oh.
But I think one of the big things about all of this that I was able to establish with his wife, Nino, is that after, you know, I mean, the man's dead for 3 days, his body in the freezer vault. So she's standing in front of, you know, picking out a grave in a cemetery. She's picking out a place where her husband's body will be put. And in her mind, she's going over other men that might be her next husband, therefore be the father of her children and help her raise her children. She was very concerned about her children. So she had all of these men's names, and then she had a list of all their characteristics. And she was thinking about this as she stood in front of the various cemetery plots.
Uh-huh.
So among the things that he did when he could talk again, he confronted his wife. He said what she was doing, named all the men she was thinking about, named all of their traits she was thinking about. And this so freaked her out and so terrified her that she wouldn't have anything to do with him for a year. I talked to Nino and I said, well, weren't you glad to have him back? She said, no.
He knew too much.
Well, he could read her mind. She said there was no privacy.
Yeah.
That's... She said, I had no privacy.
Oh.
And it was very difficult for the two of them to get back together again. They did, but it was difficult, especially for her.
Yeah, she had to put that aside. Okay, there's another one in here where there was a an accident, and the person who calls the police and tells them what he's seeing, he says, there's an accident, you need to go help, and then later says, well, there was this frog jumping up and down outside my window. The frog was jumping up and sound. Oh, fog, I'm sorry.
Well, you're talking about Oregon, just outside of Portland.
Yeah.
It was October. It was the dark of the moon. It was after midnight. The guy was traveling in his car way out of Portland, going out of town, and there was a lot of switchbacks in the road that he was on. And again, dark of the moon, after midnight, there had been a sudden a change in temperature, and all of a sudden they had a condition on the streets and the roads called black ice.
Oh, yeah.
And he didn't know. And so he's driving far too fast for the road conditions, and he slams right into a great big tree. And as he said, he floated to the top of the tree and looked down. And he saw that his right arm had been detached. His body was bleeding profusely. And he said his first thought was he wanted to save his body. So he looked around for anybody. And quite a ways away, sort of on a little bit of a ridge, was one two-story house on the second floor, sort of the right-hand side of the second floor. The light was on, and his words, he went over there. Now, I don't know how he went over there.
Mm-hmm.
He just did. And he's floating, if you will, outside this this room with the light on. And he noticed inside was a man. So he said he started yelling at the man. He yelled at him, call the police, there's been an accident. Call the police, there's been an accident. Well, later on, the police then, interviewing this fellow, said, explain here. What did you do? And he said, well, you know, he says, I saw this what seemed to be fog jumping up and down outside of my window. And he said, fog never jumps up and down. So he went and grabbed a light, a flashlight, went down and outside and started, he did call the police. And then he was looking around because he didn't know. He didn't see, he didn't hear anything. And he finally found the accident scene and was there to flash the police down. And the ambulances rushed the guy to the hospital. They were unable to reattach the right arm. The guy was now blind. He was employed as an artist, so a right-handed artist. So obviously no longer had his job.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the hospital for about 3 months. And at the end of that period of time, he got his sight back. He suddenly got his sight back. And the first thing he asked for was pen and paper. So they brought him pen and paper, and he drew the accident scene. So they called in the investigating police. They called in the guy in the house, and they all looked at the drawing and said it was as if a photograph of the actual scene. It was so accurate.
That's fantastic. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break again. And the deal is, when somebody's had a near-death experience, there are after effects. And
oh, my dear.
Yeah, that's what we want to hear more of, the after effects. So we're going to come back, the after effects of a near-death experience, because that's kind of the icing on the cake, the proof in the pudding that, yeah, you've been there, done that, and you've come back with a little something extra. All right?
Okay.
All right. We're coming back with PMH Atwater, Dying to Know You, Proof of God in the Near-Death Experience on Talk Radio KCMO. Wendy's Coffee House, KCMO Talk Radio, talking with PMH Atwater, Dying to Know You, Proof of God in the Near-Death Experience is the name of the book, but she's got several more. Okay, so if there's another one, just go to her website, and you've got two blog sites, too.
Oh, got all kinds of stuff. I got YouTube's website, newsletter, everything.
See, that's, I think people...
You name it, it's out there.
Well,
and anybody, dear, can sign up for my free monthly newsletters. I call it the newsletter for the curious.
Yes.
There's one that just went out. There'll be a special announcement come out March 13. So get on my website, www.pmhatwater.com. Sign up for the newsletter and get the special announcement on March 13.
Well, I like the questions you answer on one of your blogs, too.
I endeavor to answer questions one at a time.
Mm-hmm. The Q&A.
Yeah, all kinds of Q&As.
All right, so when people have a near-death experience and they come back, they are changed.
They are different. Now, I have the largest research base we know of so far. 21% in my research base claimed no discernible difference. In those cases where I could meet with the significant others, they all denied that. They said, yeah, they really did change. And in nearly 40 years of work, I have yet to meet a single near-death experiencer who really recognized how much they had changed afterward. So that's 21% no discernible difference, 60% significant changes, 19% radical changes. So that's a good 79% of the people who really ran into big changes that significantly made differences in their lives from then on.
Well, yeah, you're talking divorce and relationships all of a sudden going in a different direction, and then not only that, having different abilities that didn't exist before.
Well, of the physiological kind, you know, most people just talk about the psychological kind, you know, no more fear of death, become more loving, more... more into a mission or a job to do, really more healing, getting into the healing arts. But we're not talking about the physiological differences, and there are a lot of them. There are changes in brain structure and function. There are changes in the nervous system, the digestive system, and skin sensitivity. By the way, there's all kinds of sensitivities, electrical sensitivity, all kinds of sensitivities to light, touch, texture, smell, pressure, especially around storms. So lots of differences. One of the among the kinds of things I warn people about and sort of wave a red flag, so to speak, is lower blood pressure afterward is normal.
Mm-hmm.
The blood pressure really plummets, really goes down, and this is normal. You know, light sensitivity, sound sensitivity, but less tolerance of pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
So you have to be really careful of that. Most of them turn to more natural means of healing afterward, homeopathy, you know, that kind of thing. But, yeah, the divorce rate is between 71 to 77%.
Huge.
Nearly 80%. You know, let's just stop for a minute and be very honest here. The family is praying for the loved one to come back. They want their loved one back.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want back some rewired, remade individual that might be a version of their former loved one.
Mm-hmm.
They want their loved one back.
Yep.
And they get back this rewired version that they don't even understand. So there can be conflicts on both sides. What we have at the International Association of Near-Death Studies, we lovingly just use the initials and call it IANDS, I-A-N-D-S. By the way, that's their website, www.iands.org. At their big conferences that they have special rooms, special speakers, special places for the families. So the family can come in and talk about what they went through, what their questions are, and what their worries and concerns are.
What I wanted to ask, there are some others in here too. For one thing, the God factor, are they more religious, or how does that shift?
Most of them in my research base, one-third stayed in their church or their church of their choice or some kind of Orthodox religion. Two-thirds left and would go into more different types of religions, maybe shamanism, maybe another form of spirituality, maybe A Course in Miracles. They went other directions. But do you know, after about 10 to 15 years, invariably those people came back to some kind of church setting. The idea of being around minds of a like nature. So I would find these people coming back to churches like Unity. You know, you have a lot of that in your particular area, Kansas City,
mm-hmm.
and all over that area, the Unity Church, the Unity Movement, also centers of spiritual living. These used to be called Science of Mind,
yeah.
Religious Science. They're now called Centers of Spiritual Living. You find a lot of them go there, or a lot of them join the Baha'i Faith. I'm quite amazed at how many go into the Baha'i Faith, or maybe a meditation group, maybe some kind of spiritual group where you have the idea of like minds that are able to share
openly.
And,
openly, yeah.
You know, go together.
Okay, what about the 3 a.m. wake up call?
Oh yeah, well that's one of the after effects.
Annoying.
Yeah.
Really?
Annoying, but all the interesting things that happen at 3 a.m. in the morning.
I know. Yeah. Yeah, but it's just like clockwork. Hello? Okay, 3 a.m. Great. Fine.
Yeah, but you know, that's when the pineal gland in your head, all those good juices and everything that's going on with the pineal gland reach their height. That's when the earth pulse beat, which is called the Schumann waves, that's when they reach their height in use. There's all kinds of things, natural things, that begin to occur all over our globe that happen around 3 a.m. And it's like the person wakes up and sort of flows with that.
Mm-hmm.
In medical science, they call that hour between 3 a.m. and 4 a.m. The hour of the wolf. That's because of congestive heart failure. Most of your deaths happen during that time. But yet, in the more spiritual or creative circles, it's called the hour of the muse. And that's when most of your musicians or artists get up in the morning and have these great visions. Maybe a person gets up and starts poetry.
Crop circles.
Yeah.
I like that one.
Yeah, most of the crop circles across the world happen and are formed around 3 a.m. in the morning.
They got the memo.
Again, it's this idea of somehow beginning to move more in sync with the natural environment. It's almost like you're sort of pulled out of this workaday, you know, busy, busy world, and you're just sort of gently put back into the natural world around you.
The in-between. Well, you also talk about the spirit visitors. That's when the dying patients are more likely to get a visit, and that the nurses are told if anybody is
there. Well, most of your nurses know about, quote-unquote, the visitors.
Mm-hmm.
For a person who is dying, invariably, I don't care who they are, male, female, child, adult, they have visitors come, usually a few hours before, a few days before, a few weeks before they die, visitors come. Visitors from the other side getting ready.
Wow. You know what? This is a very, very quick hour. I want to go back to the kid thing. Because that's talking about what children can teach us with their near-death experiences, and people sometimes discount them. And it's so nice to hear that that little girl is being, in a way, sheltered from too much publicity and too much of the, you know, talking about this, because she's still a kid.
Yeah, right.
And part of that is being a kid for a while and then going back and saying, okay, this is what happened, what came through. So when somebody has a child who's talking about these kinds of things, what can we learn? Yeah, tough question.
It's a tough question, but I think what we can really learn, if we're willing, is to allow that child not only to talk, but watch that child afterward and what they continue to say and how they continue to behave. Because one of the things I'm finding, I'm now on another research project, working with experiencers who had their near-death episode between womb and the age of five. So I'm going after the little bitty ones. And one of the things I'm finding with those people who had an experience that young is that this out-of-the-mouth of babe syndrome that we adults get into tricks us, because we're not really looking at the child and how that affects them over the years that follow. And it's very, very, a child does not integrate their experience like an adult does.
Mm-hmm.
They do not interpret their experience as an adult does. And if you get these really small ones who have the experience, well, you know, in my book, The New Children and Near-Death Experiences, the front
of
the
piece
was written,
30
you know,
seconds.
By this fellow who had his near-death experience inside his mother's vagina as he was being born. So we've got these tiny ones who can have near-death experiences.
Okay, this is a tease. PMH, we got to go. This is a tease, but you're going to come back.
My other next book, Manual for Developing Humans.
Yes. So we're going to put the details. I'll put that on the blog site. And this stuff is so phenomenal that we're able to talk about it. There are so many stories and so many revelations about what happens during, after, and in some cases, before a near-death
experience. And they're all real.
Thank you. All right, take care. We're out
you
of here.
Too. Bye-bye.
All right.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.